Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 81. My name is Terry Frost and today I am doing a little bit different with Martian Drive-In podcast, but only a little bit. I'm doing a couple of movies that aren't the best science fiction movies in the world, but they represent a certain time in my movie viewing history. And I kind of like them as well for not what they achieve, but what they shoot for. And those two movies both star Tim Thomason. Those films are Future Cop, a.k.a. Trances, from 1984. And then we move all the way up to 1985 for Zone Troopers. Both of them are kind of very much low-budget science fiction movies. But they're interesting, they're fun, and they represent that time in history when we were all going down to stores to rent VHS tapes. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll start talking about some B, C, or D grade science fiction fun. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Okay, so how is everybody going? It's all fine here. We're just waiting for April, because April's the month when I spend a week up in Sydney. We're driving up to Sydney. It's about 850 kilometres to visit my family. So it's going to be really nice to do that for a week and kind of chill out up there, hit all the high spots we usually hit when we go to Sydney. So we're just kind of hanging out and slowly preparing for that. But apart from that, March is going to be okay, because March does seem to have a bunch of public holidays in it. We've got Easter, of course, which celebrates that rabbit, the chocolate rabbit on a cross. And then we go from there. Before that, we have in Australia what is known as Labor Day, which is a day when there was negotiation so that workers could have 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, 8 hours of sleep. There's actually a monument at the north end of Melbourne City for the 8 hour day. It's a big kind of plinth and a column with 3/8 on it for 8 hour day. So we've got a bit of that going on. And of course, the other great sport that we have here is we've been watching with a combination of amusement and horror at the ascendancy of Donald Trump in America. We don't know quite how this is occurring. We think it may be, I mean, it's one of those things that kind of makes you want to believe in chemtrails, doesn't it? But we're kind of hoping that it doesn't happen, because the last thing we want is, you know, somebody like that to have the key to nuclear weapons, for a start. And also having, yeah, it's just basically, we all know, of course, it's deeply wrong on 17 different levels, but apparently, and people have made the Idiocracy comparison, of course, but I don't think it's that. I think what it is certain kind of demagogues tell people what they want to hear, not what they need to hear, but what they want to hear. And the popularity of Trump seems directly related to people who maybe don't have too close a relationship with consensus reality, and who think that somebody is out to get them. Of course, somebody is out to get them. Very rich people are out to fuck over very poor people, as they have since the days of the caves. But it's kind of a misdirection thing. Look over there, don't look over here. It's a weird situation. And it's not a situation I expected us to find ourselves in the 21st century. I've got this conceit, and it's purely conceit. There's no real solid basis in reality that the human race is getting better over time. yes, we are in certain aspects, and that's definitely a part of my belief as a science fiction fan, apart from anything else, that things are improvable. I'm not big on dystopias. I don't think they're inevitable. I don't think they're desirable. I don't even think they make particularly fun fiction. But I think that we should be trying to be better than the generations before us rather than idolizing them and having a kind of unwarranted nostalgia for the past. I think that I know the reason why. I've just kind of flashed on the reason why that happens, why we think we have this nostalgia for the past. If people have happy childhoods, they tend to be nostalgic for the past. There's a time of their lives where they felt somewhat secure, they felt looked after. Their decision-making processes were very simple and their lives were uncomplicated. And I understand the longing for that. It's not one that I ever had. My experience of life has been very different from that. But I can understand where if things go wrong and things get complicated and things aren't going the way that your belief system wants them to, you can have that kind of nostalgia for simpler times, which is not historically based, but is personally based. And that, I think, is the key to the popularity of someone like Donald Trump. He's telling people things are simple. He's using very simplistic language. And a certain amount of people respond to that in a positive way. And that's unfortunate. Politics is at a crisis point around the world. I mean, in Australia is as well. We changed prime ministers recently for the fifth time in a few years. And the new prime minister, who was supposed to be kind of a middle ground kind of guy, sensible, urbane, and all that kind of thing, is keeping exactly the same policies as the last idiot. It's a very weird time in the political process in the world. And we'll get through it. Somehow, we'll abide. I mean, there's not a lot really that can kill us. It can weed us out. It can thin the herd. But nuclear Armageddon's less on the cards than it has been in the past, though China is doing weird things with terraforming in the South China Sea. But it's a very weird time in life, and it's not anything that was predicted at all by either futurist or science fiction people. The present is a weirder time than we imagined it would be. And yeah, from my viewpoint, having had a couple of birthdays now, I don't think it's better or worse than the past. I think there are things in the past that are monstrously bad that we rightly abhor, though some people are nostalgic for them. But I think it's different than we thought it would be, and it's not as good as we wanted it to be. We haven't necessarily become better people or better societies in the 21st century. We've let fear and self-interest rule. But we can walk away from that, and I hope we do. And that's the end of the rant for the podcast. I just went off on a tangent there and went really kind of fucking philosophical for a moment. Okay, so what have I been watching? Now, I've got the Letterboxd up, and I watched a few things. I should post a link to this as well, because I've actually done a written movie review. Yes, words on screen. For Hail Caesar, the new Coen Brothers movie, which stars, amongst other people, George Clooney, Scarlett Johansson, Channing Tatum, and a host of others. It's about a movie studio in the 1950s run by Eddie Mannix, which is a fictionalized version of Eddie Mannix, the 1940s and 1950s fixer for MGM Studios. And you know, you've seen the ads for it anyway, you've seen the trailers and things like that, and I liked it a lot. It's a very accessible Coen Brothers movie, and very broadly comedic. It's got interesting things like Tilda Swinton playing twin movie gossip columnists, very amusingly. You can tell the difference between them because one's got a beauty mark on one side and one's got a beauty mark on the other. But the movie was not successful at all. It died in the arse in the box office because it came out around the same time as things like Deadpool. But I liked it. I think it's great. If you know a fair bit about movies, which I have the conceit that I do, it's got a lot more to offer for it. It's funnier and more amusing the more you know about the history of Hollywood. And if you haven't checked it out in the cinemas, definitely check it out when it's released either streaming or on disc because it's a bit of fun. It's got some nice pastiches of things like Esther Williams, water ballets, Gene Kelly, sailor musicals, and all sorts of other bits and pieces like that. So it's a lot of fun there. And biblical epics as well. I should mention biblical epics. Yeah, so check it out if you're a movie buff. And why would you be listening to this podcast if you're not? It's worth your time. Let's just put it that way. I don't think it's up there with Lebowski or Fargo, but it's the Coen brothers being playful, and I really like that as well. Now, I did go back and revisit one of my favourite sub-genres in Western movies. And the movie is called Comanche Station. It's one of Randolph Scott's renowned movies that Bud Bedeker directed. I picked up a copy of it from Umbrella Entertainment. It was on their new releases. They actually just got the rights to doing a really nice print of Comanche Station, so I picked that up. It's basically a pared-down, very simplified Western. Randolph Scott plays a character called Cody who rescues women from Indian tribes, white women. It's, you know, he's got personal reasons for doing it, and he manages to buy a woman off an Indian tribe, and he's about to take her back to her husband. Meanwhile, a couple of kind of semi-bad guys, amongst them Claude Akins, party up with him when there's an Indian attack, and basically they all move towards bringing this woman back to her husband, while all the time wondering why her husband hasn't gone out to look for her himself. There's a reason at the end of the film, but it's a nice simplified Western filmed around the Alabama Hills, just east of Los Angeles. And the landscapes are beautifully integrated into it. I've talked about the renowned Westerns on Paleo Cinema Podcast. And it's just, you know, a perfect, simple Western. Strong female character in it as well, which is always nice, and it's something that Bedeker and Randolph Scott did in their Westerns. The female characters weren't wishy-washy at all, ever. And that makes it play better to a 21st century audience. But this one I really enjoyed a lot, Comanche Station. And I recommend that people watch it, if not buy it. So I enjoyed that, rewatching that. I did see one of the DC animations as well, Batman Bad Blood, which was kind of okay. It wasn't as good as some of the other DC animations around. It's about Batman and Robin, who became Nightwing, and the new Robin, and Batwoman and Batgirl. So it's crammed full of Bat people, including a black guy called Batwing, who's got a kind of Iron Man suit done up as Batman. So it's not one of the stronger DC animation things, but it's still fairly good. And I saw a Swiss science fiction movie called Cargo, about which I'm not going to talk too much because I may want to do it in a future Martian Driving podcast. It's a space set kind of adventure, thriller, mystery, almost horror film. It doesn't quite go into horror, but it kind of verges on horror. And it's quite interesting. I'm really saving up that one up for another podcast. Enjoyed it a lot. Filmed in 2009. Then I watched an old film from the 80s, Don Coscarelli's The Beastmaster, with Mark Singer and Tonya Roberts in it. And it's a little bit of fun. Rip Torn plays the villain with a false hawkish looking nose and tears up the scenery in it. John Amos is in it. You've got a black tiger, you've got a hawk or an eagle, you've got a couple of ferrets, all of whom the Beastmaster has as friends. And it's almost like a peplum epic mixed with sword and sorcery. And that's kind of cool. It was fun revisiting that. I picked it up for like $8 on Blu-ray, so it was worth checking out again. And the only other thing of any real interest that I watched was I rewatched the 1993 television miniseries Wild Palms, about which I've spoken on a Paleo Cinema podcast before I split the two podcasts apart. It's a cyberpunk kind of TV series written by Bruce Wagner, very fine writer who didn't get enough push in Hollywood. If you have a chance, try reading his novel about Hollywood, Force Majeure, which is very good. Wild Palms, it's got Jim Belushi in it, Robert Loggia is in it, Kim Cattrall, David Warner, Angie Dickinson, Nick Mancuso, just really good. Brad DeReef's in it as well. And it's I kind of like it. it's one of those kind of weird things. It's dated somewhat now, but it's really an interesting piece of work. One or two of the episodes were directed by Catherine Bigelow, which makes them kind of interesting, and she actually has a small role in the film too as an actor, playing the sister to Tully Wawod, the Nick Mancuso character. It's very cyberpunky. William Gibson turns up as in a cameo as himself in the first episode of the film. So it's set in 2007, filmed in 1993. And 2007 didn't turn out quite the way they expected it to, but it was good revisiting that. I really like it. At the time, it was compared a lot to Twin Peaks, but they're very much different genres and very much different approaches. But probably because they're both kind of freaky and, in a sense, too wild and too freaky for network television. It's a kind of a project that would have done better had they been able to wait, say, a decade or more, when HBO or Netflix or someone could have taken it on board and really ran with it in the right direction. They did have the kind of restrictions that you do have on network television, but I still like it. It's it holds up well. It's an artifact of its time to a certain extent, but really nice ensemble, fantastic music by Ryuki Sakamoto, and also some very borrowed music, which is really great. Robert Morse does some really fucked up versions of Beach Boys songs and All Along the Watchtower and other things in the movie as kind of lounge songs. It's in the series, sorry, not the movie. But it's definitely worth checking out if you get a chance to. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to be talking a couple of classic 1980s Tim Thomason movies, Trances and Zone Troopers. But anyway, talking about simpler times, the two movies I've got to talk about are kind of not guilty pleasures, because we all know that I don't do guilt. But they are vulgar pleasures. They're kind of science fiction movies that they weren't made by big studios. They don't have big stars in them. But they're made by people who have a respect and a love of fiction and movies of the past. Now, I'm getting conflicting information about the years these things were made. They were either made in 1984 and 1985, or 1985 and 1986. My online references are contradictory about that. But one way or the other, somewhere in the mid-1980s, before it collapsed around the same time that the Soviet Union did, a guy called Charles Band ran a small theatrical distribution company called Empire International Pictures. And Band's movies were released under that. And in Australia, they were very popular on VHS tapes. I think Richard Band wanted to be Roger Corman, but he ended up steering slightly toward, and particularly in later years, slightly toward the Ed Wood end of things. But the movies that you just saw all the time in video stores were things like Ghoulies, The Dungeon Master, Breeders, Crawl Space, Eliminators, Robot Holocaust, Troll, Terrorvision, Creepazoids, Dolls, Assault of the Killer Bimbos, Cellar Dweller, The Sorority Babes at the Slime Ball Bolarama, which I have on DVD, by the way, Robot Jocks and Spellcaster, but Empire International went belly up in 1992, and Charles Band started his second, I think it's his second production company, Full Moon Productions, which kind of went from, there was a bit of overlap, so they went from 88 to 95, and then became Full Moon Studios from 1995 to 2002, then Shadow Films from 2002 to 2004, and then Full Moon Pictures from 2004 until now. So Band, he kind of developed a few franchises. There was a Puppet Master franchise, Subspecies franchise, which was about vampires, Trances, of course. There were six Trances movies, only five of which really have Tim Thomason in them, and the last two are pretty bad. Dr. Mordred, they did a version of Pit and the Pendulum, for instance, and a new franchise called The Ginger Dead Man, which is about a kind of Chucky-style gingerbread man. And then there are movies like Evil Bong and all of the sequels. I think there are about five or six sequels to a movie called Evil Bong, which kind of shows you where Charles Band is going. But in the 1980s, he made a few kind of okay films, you know, not kind of a Citizen Kane fantastic, but good, honest little science fiction and horror films and things like that, that are above the level of, say, the Asylum or Sci-Fi Channel movies, but below the level of a big studio release, even like a big studio release. And Trances was one of them. It says here 1985, so I'll run with 1985. Directed by Charles Band, it stars Tim Thomas and Helen Hunt, who was in the first three Trances movies, in fact, just as her career started taking off, and then she kind of dropped out of the franchise when her character Lena divorced the protagonist, Jack Death, played by Tim Thomas. And now Jack Death is a hard-boiled private eye kind of cop thing. The interesting thing about Trances is it merges a few different things. It merges film noir, it merges horror, it merges with those two things, time travel as well, a little bit of comedy, punk sensibilities, and there's a few punk scenes with bands doing punk versions of Jingle Bells, for instance, as a part of one scene. So Tim Thomason, though, interesting character actor Tim Thomason, started out as a Catskills comic in the Catskills in New York State. And even though he started out as a Catskills comic, he had more of the look for a character actor. And there, you know how there are people who go into certain things that are stand-up comics, for instance, that look like stand-up comics. That's what they do. That's basically the sweet spot for them in their careers. And Tim Thomason never looked like that. He was tall. He was still is tall. Kind of muscular, craggy features, prematurely grey hair, tough guy looks, handsome guy. He didn't look like somebody who should be doing comedy, and of course that was his love, and he was very good at comedy. If you saw the short-lived television series Quark, he played the kind of sexually ambiguous Gene character. Now, part of it he was a macho dickhead, part of it he was a cliched woman, female character, and Tim Thomason played both of those roles at the time hilariously, but now you probably wouldn't get away with that with gender studies, as we know. That kind of character wouldn't be played for laughs in quite the same way it was in the early 1980s when the TV series Quark with Richard Benjamin came out. Tim Thomason is still acting, he's doing character roles and a bunch of other things, so more strength to him. He's a very likable character, and even his Jack Death, where he is playing the kind of cliched cop whose wife was killed by trances who were kind of zombified, hypnotized slaves to Whistler, the evil guy who ran trances and becomes the major kind of crime figure in 2247, when Jack Death is a police trooper in New Angeles, because Los Angeles is under the water. And in fact, in the first movie, he does go scuba diving into the old city of Los Angeles searching for artifacts. And they've got a really nice little kind of hanging mat shot of buildings popping out of the ocean. Yeah, it's one of those kind of cheesy shots where you know they're using painting on glass and filming through it on the beach to show you the building sticking out of the water. But it's of its time, and that kind of works nicely for me. So apart from Helen Hunt and Tim Thomason, you've got Art LaFleur, who was very popular in Charles Band's Empire International era for doing a bunch of these movies, as McNulty, who's the cop in charge of Jack Death. Thelma Hopkins, Richard Hurd's in there, Anne Seymour, right at the end of her career. Anne Seymour is another interesting actor who had a really long career in movies. She started out on the stage and on radio, and in 1949 she had a role in one of the best movies of all time, one of the kind of really big ones, All the King's Men. She played the wife to Broderick Crawford's character Willie Stark in Robert Rosen's All the King's Men, 1949. So she had quite a long career in movies, and was right at the end of her career when she made Trances, of course. But it was kind of nice to see that kind of nod back to that era of filmmaking. And there are a few of them as well. It's pretty obvious that the people making the Empire movies are film buffs. And the kind of film noir sensibility we get in Trances is definitely a part of that. A limited budget, as I said, and the future scenes are limited to some indoor shots and a scene at a diner where Jack Death is attacked by a trancer unexpectedly. And just to show you what they are, they kind of, you know, they get really bad skin and foam at the mouth and become homicidal. And only people of weak minds can be kind of telepathically influenced by Whistler. The technology of this isn't explained until the fourth movie, how trances came about. They came about in 2000, at the start of 2005 as a kind of super soldier program, and the trancer mix of kind of chemicals and hormones started things up. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit with that. So Jack Death has been tracking down Whistler, who killed his wife and child a few years before. He's kind of on the skids. He's really, doesn't want to be a cop anymore. He's quit his job, but they drag him back in because Whistler has actually gone back into the past. Through his own bloodline, he's gone back and occupied the body of one of his ancestors, a police captain in Los Angeles in 1985. And so the authorities, in this case the Council of Los Angeles, or New Angeles, send Jack Death back to 1985 to get rid of Whistler, to send him back up the line so that they can arrest him. But Jack Death, being the hard-boiled asshole he is, destroys Whistler's body in the 24th century and decides that he's going to send Whistler back, but when he gets back, he won't have a body to go to, so he'll die. So they send him back to the body of his ancestor, a guy called Phil, who's a photographer. And immediately we realize that Phil has just spent the night with a very young Helen Hunt, playing Lena, who's a photographer doing Christmas photos in a mall to make ends meet. She's a little bit of a punk. She's got a blue streak in her hair, but she's not particularly really punk, even though the character does say that she spent a lot of time in her teenage years hanging out with bikers and things like that. Helen Hunt really doesn't have that persona and doesn't come across as quite hard-boiled enough for the character. But what do you want? It's a Charles Band movie. It was made on a limited budget in the 1980s. So pretending to be Phil for a little while, Jack Death gets Lena's help to try to track down the ancestors of the members of the council, because Whistler has gone back there to kill their ancestors so the council never exists, and so he can come back up the line and kill, you know, basically take over the world. Yeah, that kind of stuff. I mean, they're explaining that really, really badly. Now, the interesting thing is that they kind of overcome the age difference between Helen Hunt and Tim Thomason in a very interesting way. At the time the movie was made, Helen Hunt was like 22, 23, and Tim Thomason was about 20 years older than that, maybe a little less than 20 years older than that. So the way they do it is Phil, the person whose body Jack Death occupies, is a sleazy photographer who sleeps with younger women and kind of tells them whatever they want to hear to sleep with them, basically. And so that kind of gives Jack Death and Tim Thomason an out for that kind of age disparity problem that occurs in this kind of movie. So they even had an awareness of it then, which is kind of credit to Richard Band. And also I should mention the writers of Trances, Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo, who also wrote Zone Troopers, as it happens. But Bilson and DeMeo later went on, a few years later, to do the 1991 TV version of The Flash. They were the ones who did the John Wesley Shipp version of the Flash TV series. And so they even dragged in some of the actors that who were in both of these movies, who were kind of like their travelling players. Tim Thomason was one of them. Art LaFleur, who had the perfect face for a 1940s character actor, still does. He turned up last year in an episode of Inside Amy Schumer, which is kind of cool to see him there. And also another character actor, a guy called Biff Maynard, who was an actor who unfortunately had some problems with alcoholism. And he died a couple of years ago. But in the interesting thing about this is he plays one of the ancestors of the council back in 1985. And he's playing a drunk, Biff Maynard, which is kind of one of those things where things close, you know, cruise a little close to the edge for a particular character type. He does have a redemption in the sequels too, so that's kind of nice. But in this one, he's playing an alcoholic ex-ball player who saves the day, in fact, using his ball-throwing skills at various bits. But Biff Maynard, he's kind of works really well. He has an interesting role in Zone Trippers that I'll talk about in a few minutes. But he's in there playing one of the ancestors. And, of course, the interesting thing about his character, whose name is Hap Ashby, is that he doesn't have, even though he's an alcoholic, he doesn't have a weak enough mind so that Whistler can turn him into a trancer. Remember, you've got to have a weak mind to be turned into a trancer. But even if he is an alcoholic and kind of on the skids and living on the streets, Hap Ashby doesn't have a weak enough brain to be turned into a trancer. Death also has a couple of secret weapons. He has a watch that'll give him what's called a long second, where 1 second can be stretched into 10, and he can move very quickly. Of course, they portray it as time slowing down. And there are some inconsistencies and some kind of goofs in the way that that applies in the various Transom movies. But yeah, it's one of those conceits that you can put in there. And there's also some nice humor in the film as well. Of course, you've got the fish out of water problem of Jack Death in the 20th century and talking with Lena and kind of learning how the 20th century works. He doesn't know the names of the streets in Los Angeles, for instance. He doesn't know what people eat. He doesn't know how to get around and all of those kind of things. So even though he's the tough guy, the fact that he has this lack of knowledge and is kind of clueless in the 20th century milieu makes it interesting. And Tim Thomason plays really nicely too. He stays in character and plays the tough guy all the time. But Jack Death definitely doesn't like not being the smartest man in the room. And his poor impulse control does not help things at various times as well. If there's a weak spot in this movie particularly, I would say it's the guy playing Whistler. There's an actor playing Whistler who didn't have a particularly big career and doesn't project particularly well on the screen. His name's Michael Stefani, and really he, even though he did act off and on for a number of years, going back as far as kind of 1960s TV westerns, this was his last film role, and I don't think he was particularly good. You need somebody to project. You need like Rip Torn in Beastmaster. You need somebody who's going to go slightly over the top to play the villain. And the weakness in this film is that they don't have that. And, you know, that's kind of okay. You can kind of forgo that because he doesn't get a lot of screen time particularly. And he looks like a kind of 1980s yuppie anyway. But it would have been kind of nice if they had have had a stronger antagonist in the film. You do have a number of fun action scenes, like when the mall Santa Claus gets taken over and turns into a trancer. Another one in a very 1980s kind of business, a tanning studio, where one of the ancestors of one of the counselors turns into a trancer and locks Jack Death in a tanning studio with the, of course, with everything turned up to 9, and tries to bake him to death. But there is a very nice rapport between Helen Hunt and Tim Thomason. They do play off each other nicely, even though you get the impression, and maybe it's a false impression, that Helen Hunt may have thought she was slumming doing this movie and just did it for a job just before her career started going places. Let me have a look at her filmography. And the 1990s were kind of the sweet spot when she was in Mad About You, and then did Twister, As Good As It Gets, Pay It Forward. She was in Castaway as well. She had the thankless role of playing the ex in Castaway, and then came good again in The Sessions in 2012 in a character role. So, all straight to Helen Hunt, but you do get the impression that she's slightly slumming in this movie. And then, of course, you got the kind of techno-y soundtrack of this film, which very much anchors it in the 1980s. It's kind of heavy on the synth kind of thing. In fact, the whole production design is a bit like that. It's got that kind of neon pastel look that they had in the 1980s and thought was slightly futuristic, with like jagged lightning neon and stuff like that. It's dated the movie very badly, more than a bunch of other films that came out at the same time. But at the time, though, it was considered cool and cutting edge. And having kind of a head-slamming wannabe Sex Pistol kind of punk rockers singing Jingle Bells by basically screaming it into a microphone also gives you a period feel as well. The film's budget was $400,000, which was nothing in those days, of course. Real kind of low end of things. But I'm just looking up the IMDb page, and it says here that Tim Thomason recommended Helen Hunt and Biff Maynard to the filmmakers for the roles, which is kind of cool. Helping out other actors is always something that good people do, and it sounds like from everything I've heard of Tim Thomason, he's that kind of guy. But I want to see what Bilson and DeMeo are doing these days. I think they're doing producing computer games, which is where the big bucks are. I mean, the budget on a decent computer game is three or four times as much as a tentpole movie these days. Let's have a look here. They did Red Faction stuff. They did the redoing of GoldenEye Rogue Agent computer games, James Bond Everything or Nothing, 007 Nightfire computer game. Let's have a look here. So, basically they kind of had a gap in their careers between the late 90s and the early 2000s, and now they're producing and making video games. And why the hell not? I mean, if they're not going to get the gigs in Hollywood, then definitely the way to go is computer games, because there's a shit ton of money in that these days. And the interesting thing is you've also got follow through as well with computer games. You buy the computer game and everybody buys it as soon as they can, and some computer games make $500 million in the first week of release, the really top end ones. And then of course you've got the in-game purchases and things like that, which adds to things as well. So good on them. I mean, I really like it when interesting people like Paul DeMeo and Danny Bilson end up doing something totally lateral from what they were doing in the 80s when I was watching and appreciating their stuff, and doing them now, what they're doing now. So great, good for them. But just to kind of wrap it up, Trances is a kind of nostalgic hit in a way, and it's sexual politics are at times a little bit cruddy, but then Jack Death as a character isn't the most kind of new age kind of guy about sexual politics. But it's a nice piece of its time B or C movie that I've got a fondness for because of that nostalgia. And rewatching it, I was entertained all the way through, even though I could see the flaws in it and see where the budget had let it down and other bits and pieces. But it's an original work in a sense, because nobody was doing this kind of stuff, particularly at the time. You had the Terminator movie came out in 84, of course, and so time travel was very big. But this one takes a different slant on it by adding in the film noir aspects of it as well, and keeping the tone just right and keeping it at street level as well. And there was a lot of location shooting, which is always nice, and of course saves money when you've got a $400,000 budget. But it's got actors in it I like. Tim Thomason I like, Art LaFleur I like, Biff Maynard I like as well, Helen Hunt I like, and seeing her success in The Sessions just adds to that. But it's a little bit of fun, it's a little bit of nostalgia, and it's a good, honest entertainment. And I appreciate that more than I do pretentious movies that bore the fuck out of me. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When we get back, we're moving a year forward to the World War II science fiction epic, and there aren't many films that are that. Well, it ends not particularly an epic either, which is Zone Troopers, starring Tim Thomason, Art LeFleur, Vincent Van Patten, Biff Maynard, Nazis and Aliens. That's all I've got to say. But no, well, it isn't all I've got to say, but I'll be back and I'll say the rest of it in a moment.
I'm Jack Death. I'm a trooper in the 23rd century.
Jack Death, Angel City PD, may I see your stats?
What did I do?
Under Section 7 of the Penal Code, the Council authorized me to administer you a transfer suspect examination.
You can't give me a TSE without a warrant.
I got your warrant right here, pal.
Okay. I don't want any trouble.
Hold out your...
My job is hunting transfers.
I got nothing to hide.
Finding them, negative, and singeing them.
Look out!
Of course, sometimes they find me first. Then it's a little more complicated.
How do you know Whistler's location?
We monitored a line disruption in Los Angeles, December 1985. Van Zandt, Ash, and I all had ancestors in the city then.
If you think I'm bringing that scum up the line, you got the wrong trooper.
Unless you stop Whistler, everything the Council has accomplished for the last 40 years will count for nothing.
Okay, let's say I believe this. You're a cop from the future and you're chasing this guy Piper.
Whistler.
Why doesn't he just turn you into one of these zombies? Or me?
Trancing only works on squids, people with weak minds, easily controlled. Lena, I'm from another time, another world. I don't even know what you people eat for lunch.
Okay, I got fried rice, egg rolls, and beef chow mein.
Beef? You mean like from a cow? I thought it was rough in the 23rd century. I didn't know how hot it could get.
Jack?
How's my tan? It was getting hotter all the time.
Jack?
I guess I just attract a certain element no matter what century I'm in.
This way, mister!
Anyway, I gotta run now.
I wanna ride with the lady.
Over here, Ashbeat!
Never even been here before. Trancers.
Okay, so on to Zone Troopers. Zone Troopers is a 1986, we'll say 1986 for the sake of discussion, science fiction movie filmed in Italy. It was the first production that Charles Band's Empire International did in Italy. And nice little cast too. It's got a fairly tight ensemble cast. Tim Thomason playing the sergeant. Very much in the style of a Sam Fuller sergeant, say, in a movie like The Steel Helmet, for instance. There's a little bit of that kind of going on there. And Danny Bilson, who directed as well as co-wrote the script with Paul DeMeo, is a guy who's familiar enough with cinema to know that. And he used that to kind of ground the science fictional elements that later come into the movie. In fact, I'll do this now. I'll play you a bit at the start, towards the start of the movie, where the characters who are the Sarge, played by Tim Thomason, Mittens, played by Art LeFleur, really, really nicely. I like Art LeFleur in this movie. He gets one scene with Adolf Hitler, which is fantastic, and which I'm not going to spoil for you. So we've got LeFleur playing Mittens, as I said, Biff Maynard playing Dolan, who's a kind of Ernie Pyle battlefield journalist character, and Timothy Van Patten playing Joey. Now, Timothy Van Patten, interestingly enough, is the guy who directed more episodes of The Sopranos than anyone else. He directed episodes of things like The Sopranos, Boardwalk Empire, Game of Thrones. He's done two episodes of. He's more known these days as a director than an actor. And in this one, his Joey is kind of like the Italian kid from the streets who reads science fiction magazines and is kind of over the top, enthusiastic and a little bit naive. So it's a nice little character role there. But anyway, I'll play this clip now of the guys just as they realise that they're in deep shit now. Before I do that, and I'm getting ahead of myself by wanting to play this clip because I like it. The plot's fairly simple. A small squad of American soldiers in 1944 in Italy during World War II are trapped behind enemy lines. They come upon a spaceship and an alien, which has also got the interest of the Nazis. So the Nazis are heading towards the spaceship and the alien, while this lost patrol find it as well. And ship breaks loose. That's pretty much what you need to know. But anyway, I'll play this clip now because it plays very much like a 1950s World War II drama. Maybe Sam Fuller or an Audie Murphy movie, one of those kind of films. And I think they do a nice job of the dialogue and the acting in this piece.
Sarge! They got the Sarge!
No, look!
What are you waiting for, more crabs?
Where are the rest of our guys?
We're it!
Woo!
Okay, I think we're in the clear.
Boy, Sarge, I crossed you off that time.
I guess it's true. Nothing seems to kill the Iron Sarge.
I don't want to hear that ration of bull from you or anybody. You know what saved my neck? This. Helmet. Steel. GI. Olive drab. Government issue. Nothing else. Not luck. Not magic. Not my guardian angel. Understood? Gentlemen, move on. Mitt is point.
The radio bottle with Ferguson, Sarge.
You checked it out, made sure it couldn't be salvaged?
No, sir, I did not.
Damn it, Mittens. What the hell were you thinking about?
I was thinking of my pals laying dead back there. I was thinking of you turning down that battlefield commission. If you had been in charge instead of that baby-faced lieutenant, you'd have never gotten ambushed.
So that's how you figure it?
That's how I figure it.
What commission was that?
What the hell are you doing?
Taking notes?
Ah, oh, that's swell.
Say, fellas, how much farther are we gonna hike? My dogs are screaming.
Damnest thing you ever saw. Compass won't settle.
Probably some new crowd secret weapon. Magnetic ray, perhaps.
Get a load of Buck Rogers.
Could be an iron ore deposit. Where do you figure we are, Sergeant?
I don't know. Somewhere behind enemy lines.
Do you see what I mean? This movie could play up to a certain point, like a World War II movie out of the 1950s, which is kind of cool. And given the fact that they probably had a similar budget, if not less than Trances did the year before, they do a really nice job of this too. The GIs play realistically and the actors are very committed to it. The movie's tongue-in-cheek nonetheless. They do have a couple of nice set pieces. There's a fairly big arse end of a spaceship that they build for the movie and a couple of other little bits and pieces. Lots of ex-Nazi trucks and German uniforms and cannon fodder Germans in there. But the heart of the movie is the fact that these four guys basically stumble into the biggest news, as they say in the film, this news is bigger than the war, with the fact that there are aliens and one of them has crash-landed in no man's land in Italy during World War II. And there's an alien that the Nazis have captured, which the soldiers, in part of their ongoing attempts to fuck up the Nazis, which they say in the movie is their job pretty much, basically rescue and try to help get away. And the movie stays true to that premise really well. There are no anachronisms in it. All of the actors, from the Sarge down to Joey the naive kid, play to those cliches of the small squad lost behind enemy lines stuff, but the actors do a really nice job of it, and it does play sort of realistically. It's an entertainment, yes, and its tongue is well and truly in its cheek, as it says on the IMDb reviews, but it's got a certain integrity to it, which to a bigger extent than Trances, really does them credit. I think part of that is because Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo had a bit more control on this one and could take it where they wanted to. The movie starts out with the titles playing with Glenn Miller's American Patrol playing over them, and that's a nice choice too. You can see that the guys actually cared about what they were doing here. The music choices they make and most of the script, most of the soundtrack was composed by Richard Benn, the brother of Charles Benn, the producer. And the music does kind of, for the most part, stay consistent with that. There's a little kind of, you know, Big Win from Winnetka type drum roll, big band jazz piece playing in various bits that really works well to support the action. The mistake they don't make in this movie that they made in Trances was they don't need a particularly big villain because, you know, hordes of Nazis makes a sufficient villain. You don't need to get a strong character actor to play the villain in this place. You know that the older guys are the officers, particularly the fat one, and the younger guys are the cannon fodder German soldiers. That's all you pretty much need to know about the Nazis. You can tick that box and say, yes, there's an antagonist in the film. The alien they kind of pal up with, you can tell that the makeup effects are very much kind of lowish budget 1980s. It's got a head like a kiwi fruit with big bug eyes and mandibles around the mouth and a wide mouth. You can tell it's a mask with prosthetics and animatronics attached to it. And you kind of forgive that too because it's that kind of movie where you don't expect everything to look as good as, say, Predator did a few years later. It's, yeah, you go, okay, fair enough, Alien. Now, the Alien's got a secret, too. There's something about the Alien you don't know at the start of the film, which is kind of cool. And, yeah, it just plays out. The battle scenes are done really nicely, too. Given a limited budget, they, you know, there's a lot of machine gun fire and mortar fire and things like that. In fact, before they first meet the alien, there's a mortar shot which breaks off a chunk of the tree which is falling towards the group, and the alien disintegrates it and turns it into sawdust in midair, which is kind of a cool thing. And that's the lovely thing I like about DeMeo and Bilson's work. They always worked with limited budgets in every project that they did, and in movies at least. And they substituted imagination for budgetary constraints. The TV series of The Flash had a fairly limited budget in the early 1990s, but they made it work. They got in interesting character actors. They created an Art Deco-y style for that, and they really made it work. It's a shame it didn't run more than the season or two that it ran. But anytime I see their name on the credits of an old movie, and of course they are old movies now, they're all 20, 30 years old, I like it because I know that at least these guys have a bit of imagination going for them. They've got a strong sense of movie history, and they're going to give you full value to whatever extent the budget permits. And I've got a lot of respect for that. I really do like it. And I think that this is one of the best of the movies that Charles Band produced because it takes that concept of World War II patrol meet aliens. Fair enough, you can kind of run with that, you know. You can say it's cross between Steel Helmet and E.T., just to get it across to the Money Men, for instance. And it stays true to that really well. It's very much a step above the kind of Sci-Fi Channel movies and the Asylum movies, as indeed was Trances. Because I think that people cared about what they were doing. It wasn't purely about the budget, it was what you could do with the budget. And I think one of the problems of the Sci-Fi Channel movies and the movies made by the Asylum, the studio, are that it's more about what you can do with the bucks. It's more about the bucks and the restrictions and the cheesy special effects and things like that. And this movie has a kind of integrity to it, which is why it's getting a Blu-ray release in the 21st century, because a lot of films of that time, and indeed a bunch of films that Charles Band produced and in some cases directed, that don't get that love and respect that Zone Troopers and Trances do. And I think the reason is Tim Thomason's a bloody good actor for a start. Having DeMeo and Bilson do the scripts is another big plus. And they definitely let you know that this movie is meant to be fun. It's meant to have its tongue in cheek. It's meant to be funny. And there's a scene with Hitler and Mittens, played by Art LaFleur, along with Biff Maynard's character Dolan, is hilarious. It comes out of left field and it just works really well. And all credit to the writers for that, because I think that there's not a war movie where they have a better Hitler scene than Zone Troopers. I don't care what you say. What happens in there is very funny and kind of works really nicely, even if nobody's ever going to believe them later on. But yeah, this movie, and because it also has the movie of the era to a certain extent, the kind of, you know, big band, drummy kind of music, and having American Patrol at the start, it doesn't suffer from dating as much as Trances and the Trances sequels do, because it is kind of, in that sense, even in the 1980s, it was an historical movie set 40-odd years before. It kind of works and it hasn't dated as much. And I like that too. I like the fact that, you know, the movie, A, tried to do this on the budget that they had. And it's a fairly ambitious thing to try to do, to tell a story of an alien crash landing on Earth during World War II with a limited budget in Italy. I think that, you got to admire the guys for doing that and doing it as well as they did. It's a very satisfying movie. You like it right from the beginning to the end. It doesn't kind of wuss out on killing people. There are a number of characters in the movie who die, and not only from the bad guys, and they make that beautiful choice, which I really approve of, and it gets a big tick with me, is they don't let the aliens magically resurrect dead people. And in fact, it's commented on in the script and in the movie. It's one of those things where if you're dead, you're dead. And so that kind of keeps a sense of urgency. There's none of that hand-waving magical resurrection shit in this film, which is nice. There's a couple of things the aliens can do, which is very cool. Disintegrating Nazi tanks is always a nice one. But again, they kind of keep that in control and don't let it overwhelm things, to keep the characters where they need to be to tell the stories that they've got. And yeah, great stuff. I just like this movie a hell of a lot. Rewatching it was a lot of fun. I watch it every 2 or 3 years, in fact. And rewatching it this time, because I'd recently seen The Steel Helmet, the Sam Fuller movie, which again I recommend highly. I can see the homages that are in this film to a few other pieces of cinema, and it doesn't do it in a way that disrespects the stuff that is offering the homage to, which is something that a low budget film can very easily do. And it's the fact that they know these earlier films shows that these guys know what they're talking about. But Zone Troopers, if you haven't seen it, it's a hell of a lot of fun. Please see it. In fact, it's on YouTube in its entirety. I'm going to post the link on the Paleo Cinema Cafe and on my personal Facebook page. And I'll put the link into marsdrivein.blogspot.com as well, so you can watch the video of Zone Troopers and not have to worry about it. It's been the video that's up there is, I think, by the producers, so it's totally kosher. And if you haven't seen the film since the 1980s or the 1990s and you had the VHS tape either owned or rented, and I think at one stage I did own an ex-rental VHS tape of Zone Troopers, which I later discarded when I got rid of all of my VHS. I think it's worth revisiting. It is a lot of fun. You can watch it with a few friends and just kind of enjoy it. You can enjoy it by yourself. But it shows that Tim Thomason is a movie god, of course. And Thomason and Charles Band had a falling out on the fourth and fifth Trances movies, because Charles Band did the dirty on Tim Thomason by saying, you know, you're going to get paid X thousand dollars for doing this film. But when he got to Romania, where they filmed the fourth and the fifth one back to back, he found out that he was getting the US dollar equivalent in Romanian currency as his payment, so he could only spend the money in Romania. So that kind of screwed him on his association with Charles Band. They did a couple of other things with him before that, including Doll Man, which is kind of fun if you get a chance to see that, and that's got a few bits of amusement to it. But in general, these are the two, I think, arguably the two best films that Charles Band did during that era when Empire International was his studio. You can argue with me about it. If you like Ghoulies, you can say that. But I kind of like these ones because they got a decent actor, they're a bit of fun, they got decent writers in them, and they're ambitious for the budget. And I always got a kind of, not grudging, but deep-seated respect for people who you know, bite off more than they can chew and chew like buggery. But anyway, that's about it for Zone Troopers. See it. You can see it on YouTube. You've got no excuse not to. And it's a lot of fun. But anyway, I'm going to take another break. I'm going to get back. I've got a very special bit of feedback from our friend Richard. Oh, I just checked as well. The VHS, Australian VHS copies of Zone Troopers are selling for $60 US on eBay. Wow, I'm a bit stunned by that. But anyway, we're back again. And there was nothing in between me saying the earlier bit and saying this bit because I couldn't find any audio to put in the middle. So I've got two bits of feedback, and I'll do the one I got as an email first. And it's from Gary Lettergen. And Gary says, "Hi, Terry. Thanks for doing Night Stalker. I'd almost forgotten about it. I do remember seeing it in 1972. It was also interesting to find out that there was a second film. I guess I missed that one because I was on my last semester at college and didn't have much time for TV. Luckily, YouTube has both films, so I downloaded them, and I'm looking forward to seeing The Night Strangler. The Kolchak TV series was one of the few shows I watched with any regularity in the 1970s. Armin's comments on H.P. Lovecraft were good. It would be interesting to see a movie based on At the Mountain of Some Madness, but since most of the horror takes place in the minds of the protagonists, it would be pretty much impossible to do. I personally consider that to be one of HBO's best stories." Gary. Hi, Gary. I haven't read it for a very long time, At the Mountains of Madness. But, Lovecraft's one of those things that is quite hard to adapt well and quite hard to adapt regularly, respectfully, because of that, the horror taking place in the mind and the fact that the bombastic way that Lovecraft described the horrors doesn't so much create mental pictures as create mental moods. So, yeah, there's some problems with it, but I'm sure we'll be seeing Lovecraftian movies of various kinds into the future. In fact, there's a book that came out that's been recommended to me, a novel called Lovecraft Country, which is a horror movie with old gods and things like that in it. So that might be worth finding a copy of if you're able to. Now, the other bit of feedback I got was from our friend Richard. And I'm going to let Richard speak for himself on this one because I think it's respectful that I do.
Hello, everyone. This is Richard, the Monster Movie Kid, calling to you from Kansas City. And I'm leaving this voicemail to a couple of different podcasts. I'm leaving this for the B-Movie cast and the B-Movie Clubhouse gang, Vince, Mary, Nick, Juan. I'm leaving this for Derek over at Monster Kid Radio, Terry over at the Paleo Cinema and the Martian Drive-In podcast. I'm wanting to kind of collectively, just very publicly, thank everyone who listens to these shows, who have reached out to me in the last week with prayers and thoughts and warm wishes and condolences. My dad passed away on the 17th of February, and while it wasn't totally unexpected, his turn at the end came rather quickly, within about 36 hours. He had been battling Lewy body dementia for a while, and especially over the last year, he'd been in a facility, and he had been slowly robbed of everything that was him, up to and including the ability to communicate over the last several months. So it wasn't necessarily unexpected, and in many ways it was a blessing that my dad passed away last week. It is still one of the hardest things I've ever done. If you've listened to these various podcasts over years or read my blog, you will know that I have often talked about my dad. My dad was a big kid. He was a Trekkie. He was a monster movie kid like me. He was really one of us. He didn't necessarily always let people see that side of him. And in fact, one of the people I talked to last week, I just met, she had been taking care of my dad at times over the last year. She was totally shocked to hear that side of my dad. I said, "But you know, my dad," I said, "he was 80 years old. He went to his last Star Trek convention just about 4 years ago, and he loved it. And he loved it because I loved it." My dad and I would watch the Creature Feature every Saturday night. And although it had been many years since we watched a scary movie together, my dad would continue to watch Turner Classic Movies and would continue to share with me whenever he saw a movie that he thought I would enjoy. And I will definitely miss those phone calls from my dad. This has been one of the hardest weeks I've ever had to go through, but my dad's at peace. And the one thing that really helped me get through the last week is all of you, with all of your personal messages to me, your responses on Facebook. You really don't know how much that helped me get through the last week, dealing with grief and funeral planning. But thankfully, my dad had so much of that already planned. You know, a little bit of family drama thrown in, which unfortunately always tends to pop up at times like these. It was my occasional moments of sitting down on my phone and reading Facebook that just kind of gave me the strength to go on. And so I just wanted to publicly thank each and every one of you for everything you've done in the last week. And I just ask you, if you have a few moments, go to my blog, monstermoviekid.wordpress.com, and check out my tribute to my dad that I wrote several days ago. It is only a small portion of what made my dad really, truly amazing through his life, serving in the Marine Corps, the local Chamber of Commerce, serving as a deacon in the Catholic Church. Above all else, he was a great husband to my mom. They were married, well, would have been married 64 years in just a couple months. And that's amazing in itself. And he was an amazing dad. And I definitely have so many great memories, as many of you have heard over the years past. So thank you for allowing me just to share with you a few moments to say thank you. This podcast community we've created is just truly amazing. And whenever you think and you experience something lousy on Facebook or see a lousy post, you know, tune that out and just embrace all of the great things that have happened in the last decade of our lives by becoming a podcast community through these simple little two-hour shows that are produced every week. But they're not simple at all. There's a lot of time and effort that goes into making them, and we all love listening to them. But above all else, we've created a lot of friendship and community, people that we'll never even probably see face-to-face, and people that live on the other side of the world. That is some of the good that's come out of the world that we live in today. And I think that's what we really need to focus on and embrace and eliminate all the negative. With that, I'm going to say thank you very much again to everyone. Take care, and we will talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. Please, people, go over to Richard's blog and see what he's written about his dad. It's respectful, and it's apart from anything else, it's interesting and heartfelt. I'm glad we were able to be a small part in at least letting you manage the things you had to go through in the last few weeks, Richard. So all credit to you as well for staying strong and getting those things done. So I'm going to end the podcast there on that note. Again, listen to good movies. Talk to people you like. Talk to people you don't like. Discuss movies. Keep watching the skies. Look after yourselves. And I'll be back next week with the Paleo Cinema podcast, in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. And as usual, here are the credits for the Patreon supporters for Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive-In podcast. Thanks to the supporters as well. And I will talk to you guys, or at least talk at you guys, very soon. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive-In podcast, done in the style of movie credits. Thank you very much to all of the people who've supported the Patreon campaign, and you can do that too by going to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Elaine, the scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, who is our director of monster effects, and you can find his stuff at CushingHorrors.com, and Eric as our set security head. And David Luce is our First Amendment Council. So thank you very much to all of the people who have supported the podcast financially via the Patreon campaign.